And if we were to keep our faces turned to high winds, salt spray, mountain humming green, and if, ending, the two of us had been a major lift spilled lucent through this world, and if it came to nothing, all we'd learned, and sequined glow and giant's eye half seen, was all this quiet companionship might mean, our human urge to linger fast adjourned, I'd be content with rapture by the wind. I'd leech into rich silt, the levees spent. I'd sink and cut my own path through the clay. And if, as four hands, warm half, ice half limbed, my dusk breath fears the final summons sent, I'd go. You know I'd love you more each day. So I think abolition, for me, it makes really clear that, as Ruthie says, it's presence and not absence.
Yeah.
So abolition orients you towards what it is you want to see in the world, what it is we actually need to flourish.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of agenda, because I think it's not that I think that other framings are wrong, or, you know, like, I think there are many different ways to get rid of borders, right? But I guess for me, there is something missing in that kind of tear it all down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I guess I'm interested in what comes.
Welcome, everyone, to an English episode of The Verbranders, a podcast on Europe's borders and resistance against them. I'm Neske Barwald.
And I am Wiebe Ruitenberg.
The Verbranders is Dutch for haraga, an Arabic word used in Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. Haraga literally means those who burn, and is used to speak of people who cross European borders without permission. It refers to the burning of identity papers. Those who do haraga burn Europe's borders. Our guest today is the amazing Gracie May Bradley. We talked to Gracie about a book she co-wrote with the equally amazing Luke Den Rona. We recorded an episode with Luke as well last year, which you should really listen to if you haven't already. The book Gracie and Luke wrote together is called Against Borders: The Case for Abolition. In it, they draw inspiration from prison abolitionism and the black feminist politics that shape it, and they bring that body of thought and practice to the work of organizing against borders. We talk about the harm borders do, the hierarchies they produce, and the importance of dismantling them, and how prison abolitionism teaches us to do this work of dismantling alongside the equally important work of building the worlds we want to live in, with the ultimate goal of shrinking borders into non-existence. Gracie explains how this work is intergenerational and collective, and that the isolated hero doesn't exist. We also ask Gracie about what it is she loves, and what she dreams of and is fighting for. We asked her to bring three pieces of art, which we weave into the conversation. One of these is a stunning poem she wrote, which you just heard her recite at the start of this episode. If you want to learn more about borders, the case against them, and abolitionism, we recommend everyone to read Gracie and Luke's book. And we are curious to hear your thoughts on this episode. Get in touch with us if you want to, and share this episode with people to whom you think this conversation might be of meaning. Enjoy.
All right, so welcome, Gracie. Thank you for being with us. We are so excited that you were able to actually come to Amsterdam as well to do this recording with us and to be in conversation about your book, Against Borders, about border abolition in general, about love. And we're very much looking forward to this conversation. So we thought it might actually be nice to start with inviting you to talk a little bit about yourself and what brought you on this path, or what your path towards border abolition has been like.
Just a small question. Just a small question to start with. And no, I should say, you know, right at the beginning, thanks so much for having me. You've already heard me wax lyrical about being in Europe. But I think also after so long of, you know, just having to do these things remotely and having to be separate from people. It's just really, really nice to be actually in the same space. It's really special. Yeah, so it is a big question. Where to start? I suppose I can start with where I'm literally from. So I was born in Leicester in the Midlands. That's where I grew up. That's where a lot of my family still are, most of my family. I've got my great nana, who was from Leicester, from a family of haberdashers, white British women. And then we have my grandma, her daughter, my granddad, who was an American GI, Black American GI, who was stationed in the UK in the, I think the 60s or the 70s, something like that. And then my dad's parents are from Antigua and the Gambia. So, and my mum was born in the States. My mum and my uncle were born in the States. But my grandma and my granddad lived for a little while. So when I say all my family's in Leicester, that's everyone who's not in Philadelphia, right? So a really mixed family, working class family. And I guess I come from a family of people who are generally in other people's business in some way, right? So my mum is a therapist now, but she was a community development worker for a long time. She ran Sure Start centres. My grandma was in the NHS. She was a mental health nurse and she became a trauma therapist. And, you know, my uncle is a mental health nurse. My auntie Celeste is a teacher. My auntie Tash is a social worker and a therapist. So everybody is in someone else's business, basically, but very much in the business of caring about other people, right? And that's what my family is like insofar as among the kind of older people in my family, you know, lots of people have been together and broken up and not living in kind of heteronormative nuclear relationships. And so, you know, I grew up, you know, for the first few years of my life in my grandma's house with my mum, but also with my twin aunties who were 16, 17 when I was born. And I'm the eldest of 12, 13 grandchildren. And we all kind of grew up together in Leicester, in and out of each other's houses, in and out of my grandma's house. Dads were pretty not in the picture. So aunties and grandma kind of second parenting, etc. So there isn't a way to draw a straight line between kind of where I started there and where I am now. But I mean, if you think about it a bit, you can see part of how I ended up here. So that's my family. And I suppose intellectually or from an organizing perspective, as I said, my grandma was a trauma therapist, and she worked for specialist services, specialist doctor surgeries in Leicester. And she told me to apply to be on the reception for these. You could kind of do, in England, we call it bank staff. So it's where you're covering if somebody's not there. So I signed up to be on the bank, which meant that I would get sent to do reception for different doctor surgeries. But two of the surgeries, one was a specialist surgery for people seeking asylum, and one was a specialist surgery for homeless people. And maybe it's a kind of bland liberal statement to make, but I feel like if a lot of people had that work experience at 17, 18, 19, quite a lot of people would end up with politics that are not dissimilar to mine. Sure, there would be people who got radicalized the other way, etc. But I think if you are face to face with people and have an understanding of what's happened in their lives and an understanding of how they're being treated by the state in that moment, you're probably going to become an adult who thinks, maybe this should be different. So I would say that was a really important part of how I ended up doing migrant solidarity work. And yeah, I was at Oxford, I read philosophy and French. And so my kind of intellectual grounding for all of this comes through French philosophy. So it comes from Césaire and Fanon and Glisson, and having read way too much Sartre and Camus, and that's where I get my existentialist commitments from. So yeah, those are the kind of practical life and intellectual influences that have me where I am.
Yeah, I love that you, well, I love a lot of things about what you just said, but I love that you kind of point to all the women, I guess, in your life, and perhaps not only women, but that's the people you mostly seem to mention.
Yeah.
Also because you yourself, you make the point quite often when you speak and when you write that we are so socialized to think of ourselves as individuals, whereas obviously we are, in fact, we're so connected, so shaped, so part of these larger ecosystems, as you call them.
Yeah.
And do you want to talk a little bit about that idea of being part of an ecosystem and how that connects to Black feminism and to abolitionism, which is where you, I guess, are now and what we're here to talk about today?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's so much that I could say about abolition, but I think that in my organizing work, in my professional work, I suppose we can see all of these structures that are inadequate, right? So we see how our ideas about leadership, for example, are inadequate. This idea that there will be kind of one patriarchal sovereign who will hold all of the power and has all of the skills to solve all of the problems, and they can do it on their own like a little miserable island. You know, we know that doesn't work. And maybe it's because I read philosophy. I feel like the joke pertains to philosophers in particular, that, you know, right, Descartes sitting around being like, oh, I exist because I am a thinking thing, you know, but does the external world exist? And, you know, like, there's a woman sweeping his floor. There's a woman making his food. Yeah. There's a woman who nursed him. There's a, you know, like, the idea that you could somehow erase all of that is a fiction. But it's a fiction from where so many thought experiments start. So I think when it comes to abolition and when it comes to Black feminism in particular, there's this insistence on our interconnectedness, that our point of departure is one of not just interconnectedness, but co-constitution, right? That we lose meaning and we also lose our abilities to live and flourish if we're not in connection with one another, if we're not in relation with one another. So that's something that's very important to me, and making that visible, making that work visible is important to me. I think in part because I've been in a lot of spaces, professional and, you know, grassroots, where that work is invisibilized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we are always already in relation with one another. The question is, what kind of relation, right? And if you become more intentional about these relationships, you can pour love into them.
Absolutely. And I think there's also something in Black feminism that is, there's an anti-heroism in it, right? In that there's an absolute recognition of how much needs to change. You know, as Ruthie Gilmore says, change everything. So there's a recognition of the scale of what we need to do, but there's also a recognition that, it's not going to be one person that does that on their own. That's not how history gets made. That's how history gets written, but that's not how change actually happens. And so if we continue to organize on the basis that all it's going to take is one plucky person who you know, refuses to go to the back of the bus or whatever, like that's not we're not going to get to the change that we want to see in the world. And we have to recognize that we are building on the work of people that came before us. We're building on the work of people who are with us now. And there will be people who come after us who continue to build. And for me, that's a profoundly relaxing isn't the word, but
reassuring.
It's reassuring, right? It's okay, we're sharing this. We're sharing this. It's, I'm not going to do any of it on my own. And so my failures are not only my failures. And if we want to call them wins, they're not only one person's wins.
Yeah. And once you start to really, I don't know how you say this in English, but look the beast into the eye. Not that that's a Dutch expression, by the way. But if you really start to come to grips with what change everything means, it becomes also easier to be a bit humble about about the role you need to play in that. And but then I guess how to stay active. And yet also humble. And find your place in the ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly. Because there are so many different things. That need doing.
Like what?
Well, I mean, even when we think about running organizing meetings, there's very basic stuff, you know, who's going to take the notes? Who's going to prompt us to make a decision about where we want to save the notes? Who's going to make sure that there's tea? Who's going to make sure that we're in a space that is accessible for everybody? Who is going to facilitate a discussion around, you know, what kind of space we even want this to be? Who's going to look after the kids? Who's going to reimburse people for transport? Who's going to figure out where we get that little bit of money from? I think you know, and I said it to you a few days ago, I think that it's great to have people who speak well, speak mm-hmm. about organizing, but then you end up with this idea that oratory or charisma or just having a really clear vision are the things that we need to make the change that we want to see in the world. And it's not to say that there's no place for those things, but you can see people kind of selecting themselves out when they think, well, I could never get up on mm-hmm. a stage and do X, or mm-hmm. I can't formulate my thoughts in this way. And it's like, that's not yeah. the point.
Yeah.
Or even like, I cannot be that hero, right? Like, I also experience as liberating hearing you talk about that, like, maybe I won't be that hero, you know, and it's liberating to think that there's other ways of doing that as well. Yeah.
So we're here to talk about the book that you wrote mm-hmm. together with Luke de Narona, mm-hmm. with whom we recorded an episode as well. Definitely have a listen for those of you who haven't. But the book that you co-wrote together is called Against Borders, mm-hmm. The Case for Abolition. To us, what you really do there, or what you bring to a much larger conversation around, I guess, people struggling for migrant justice, people struggling against illegalization, against borders, is to really bring that abolitionist perspective into that conversation. And could you talk about prison abolitionism and perhaps also the conversations you and Luke had as you were gearing up to writing this project together and your choice of going for that frame?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Interesting question. So there have been many different movements against incarceration in different spaces and in different times. I suppose when I am thinking about prison abolition, I'm thinking about the, in particular, Black feminist organizing in the US. Critical resistance, for example, is an enormous mover. Mm. I'm thinking about prison abolition as practiced and theorized by Ruthie Gilmore and Angela Davis, Mariam Makaba. And that's essentially the recognition that prisons don't do what people say they do. So they don't deal with harm. They don't deal with social problems. As Angela Davis would say, they disappear human beings. Mm-hmm. That's what prisons do. They don't make it any less likely that harm will occur in the future, and they enact enormous violence on the people that are incarcerated in them. And so the prison abolitionist movement, as it has existed in the US, is really motivated by this idea that there's got to be something else, right? We've got to shrink the prison industrial complex into non-existence. And at the same time, we need to build and practice ways of being that mean that A, less harm happens, like less harm is perpetrated, but B, that when harm does occur, we have ways of dealing with that that aren't disappearing people.
Yes.
So there's a recognition that actually crimes of poverty, for example, or crimes that are to do with retaliation against, you know, perpetrators of sexual violence, for example, those are key reasons that people are in prison mm-hmm. in the States, but also things like traffic violations, for mm-hmm. example.
Yeah.
But there is not, you know, prison abolitionists do not ignore the fact that people do get incarcerated because harm has happened, right? Mm. So it's not that prison abolitionists are saying, well, there's no harm at all and therefore there should be no prison. They're saying, no, there is harm. You know, yeah. there are lots of things that are harmful, but actually prison isn't dealing with that anyway. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're not saying, oh, there's no rapists, but they're saying, actually, prison is not a way to deal with rapists, and actually very few rapists end up in prison. We need another way of yeah. responding to that, the harm that is sexual violence. And there's a recognition that it's not only the spectacular acts mm-hmm. of harm that need dealing with, right? There's a recognition that actually the slow violence of poverty is a problem, that misogyny, mm-hmm. right from catcalling to sexual assault, like all of those things are problems, but also the way that sexism yeah. expresses itself in terms of who does what work and who gets paid for what, right? These are all problems for prison abolitionists. So their definition of harm and their definitions of violence are actually far more expansive than the state and the prison industrial complex would recognize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You write about it, and I really love this phrasing, but transforming the conditions to which prisons or borders, but we'll talk about that later, are a response.
Mm. And I guess in the States in particular, you obviously can't ignore the extremely racialized dynamics of the prison industrial complex. It's not only racialized, it's also classed, it's also ableist, it's many things, but obviously that racial dynamic is extremely stark
yeah.
in mm-hmm. the US. We obviously also see it in Europe,
mm-hmm.
you know, that massive disproportionality. That's why it's abolition feminism is the call,
yeah.
right? And I suppose in all of it, there's a recognition that, as Ruthie Gilmore would say, racism is about vulnerability to premature death,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
We're not locating the harm in, oh, somebody's had a bad thought about someone or said a bad word about someone. It's the recognition that the state is violent.
Mm-hmm.
The state is enacting enormous harm and very often racialized harm. So if we want to be anti-racist, we have to deal with the prison industrial complex. And I suppose the contention that we're making in Against Borders is that if we want to be anti-racist, we also have to abolish borders.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough to say, oh, well, let's be nice to migrants or look at who the Prime Minister of the UK is, right? There's a whole architecture that has to go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, as Luke always mentions, it's not just racist and racialized, but also racializing.
Yes.
It is productive of race
mm-hmm.
And of racialized distinctions, these types of architectures.
Yes.
Prisons, but also borders.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, you asked about the conversations that Luke and I had
yeah.
in landing on the book, and our paths had crossed in various places, and often we'd be discussing the hostile environment,
mm-hmm.
Or we might be discussing immigration detention. I was like, oh, here's somebody who's thinking along similar lines to me. And that was what he was thinking about me. And so we thought, is there something that we can do together? And I mean, for me, that there were lots of things that I couldn't do, and there were lots of things I was being told that I couldn't do and say in my job, and I knew that that was untrue and was looking for a way to demonstrate that. So yeah, I mean, the moment mm-hmm. of inception was I was at a party and I just texted Luke to be like, shall we do a book, Luke? And he was like, sounds interesting, Gracie. What might we do a book on? And I was like, border abolition. And Luke being Luke, he was like, let's chat about it. So yeah, I mean, and you can't have those exchanges with everyone.
I must say, this sounds actually really similar to half of our yeah. text messages as well between Viva and
I. I was like, oh, that sounds familiar. Yeah. Yes, sayer.
Like, come with kind of these big proposals in a 3-line text
yeah.
message.
Yeah.
I think that's actually how you ended up here in Amsterdam. Me texting Viva like, yeah. shall we invite Luke and Gracie over to come and do an episode with us in Amsterdam? And to
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, great things happen in the texts. What can I say?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I suppose when I say that Luke and I were thinking along similar lines, part of what we were doing was thinking against innocence. So from different perspectives, we'd both ended up in this place that recognized that we're not just going to be able to keep fitting people into the right box.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
There's yeah. always going to be somebody that falls out. There's always going to be somebody not deserving, or the state's just going to redefine something and then they're not a survivor of torture anymore. They're not a child anymore.
Yeah.
They're not a victim yeah. of trafficking anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we both had this deeply held recognition that
yes.
the boxes don't hold everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they always put the people placed in the boxes in a position of proving
yes.
their fit.
Yeah.
And they direct attention away from the violence of the boxes.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. So there was this whole thing about boxes, and then I guess I had been thinking about and working on just policing more generally, and Luke obviously had done all of his brilliant work on deportation from the UK to Jamaica. So we both really wanted to make more explicit that link between the criminal punishment system and the immigration
yeah.
system. And we felt that the book would be a really important place to do that, because very often in migrant justice circles, you are kind of still hearing, you know, asylum seekers are not criminals, or they shouldn't be in detention, they haven't committed any crime, etc. And we both were kind of, yeah, we both had experience of working with and being with people who were at that intersection and knowing, okay, well, still this person shouldn't be treated this way. Mm. So yeah, there was something against innocence that we had in common. But I think we also both recognize that we have been in very different intellectual and organizing spaces. There are things that we both actually think differently about. Mm. And so we knew that if we did something together, it would be more than, it would be different to something that, anything that either of us could do just on our own.
Yes.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I really, what the book really brought for me is giving me kind of language to think about borders in a different way and sort of thinking about the struggle against borders in different ways. You already mentioned this phrase like shrinking, which I find very beautiful, sort of like shrinking borders into non-existence, I think you use. But then also like when you talk about these categories, you and Luke use this phrase exploding the categories rather than trying to fit more people into them. So it's really giving me sort of this language, like rephrasing how we talk about this struggle. And I think actually the name of our podcast also is, it comes from that sort of like trying to find other kinds of languages to think about illegalization, migrant justice, etc. Mm. But I was wondering if you could maybe sort of spell out for us what for you abolition really brings to the struggle against borders.
Yeah.
What it does, if, I mean, this is one thing, but there's more things, of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is something that Luke and I talked about quite a lot because he's very familiar with the kind of no borders organizing and also academic literature, you know, from people like Bridget Anderson, for example. Whereas I have actually, literature on migration is not actually something that I've studied in a formal setting. So I think abolition for me, it makes really clear that, as Ruthie says, it's presence and not absence.
Yeah.
So abolition orients you towards what it is you want to see in the world, what it is we actually need to flourish.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of agenda, because I think it's not, I think that other framings are wrong, or, you know, like, I think there are many different ways to get rid of borders, right? But I guess for me, there is something missing in that kind of tear it all down.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm interested in what comes, not even what comes afterwards, but like what, there are many ways to tear something down, right? You know, you can literally erase it, but you can displace things. You can turn away from things. Mm-hmm. There are many ways to get rid of something. Mm-hmm. So I think I just, given the political moment that we were in when the book was, when we were conceiving of the book and as we were writing it, I think we just really wanted to give language to this idea that actually it is okay to build towards something. Mm-hmm. It is okay to say, maybe this is the world that we want, not just the most that we can hope for. Like, I think is that there's just something about construction. And I think for me personally, if abolition requires of us that we find ways to actually deal with harm, that means that we have to change our relationships with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, there was, in thinking about border abolition, there was like an emphasis on humanity and on the very tiny links between us, that in certain spaces, I've seen that humanity just, there wasn't room for it. It wasn't felt to be important.
Mm-hmm.
It was fine to be saying smash the state, but still to be treating each other like crap in our organizing.
Yes.
And for me, that was not okay.
Yeah.
There are obviously, you don't have to have abolition to have an organizing space where you prioritize your relations with one another and figure out ways to deal with harm. But just for me, it's something that helped me get there.
And one thing I really like also is the way you write about the need of having a vision, while also insisting that you're not going to spell out a roadmap to get there, and paying attention to what you call the critical openings in the present, where we're building our future world now.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, okay, one more thought. It also, to me, really builds this idea of the ecosystem, and not also the ecosystem in time. So the people who came before you and the people who will come after you. So playing a part in setting up future struggles in a bit better than how we found ourselves or something like that.
Yeah.
But can you talk a little bit about that, I guess, to use a fancy word, temporality?
I can.
More about it,
I think, again, our discussion of temporality is rooted in a very concrete place, in that we could, or certainly in my experience, especially in the NGO sector, I could see that people were thinking, well, we all work on migration, so we're all part of the same movement and we're all trying to do the same thing. And actually, it's pretty rare that people actually discuss what is it that we, apart, you know, people have been firefighting for so long. For the most part, everyone is united in, we don't want this bad thing to happen. But the kind of what next, people haven't had a chance necessarily to think about, to articulate. And I think the reality is that there are different actors in the space who have really different theories of change, implicitly very different visions of where they think they're going, but crucially are on completely different clocks. Because there'll be somebody who is funded to do a particular thing around a piece of legislation for 18 months. And so why would they think about what they're making possible? Why would they think about the impact that their work right now is having on what people might want to be doing in a decade?
Yeah.
Whereas there are people in the ecosystem who are thinking, actually, our big vision is this world where people have got the freedom to move and the freedom to stay. And so in this moment, we want to, do something that improves people's lives now, but we want that change to keep the way open for something even better that comes afterwards. And these are fundamentally different clocks.
Yes.
But ironically enough, there's like not enough time to think about time. wanted to give voice to some of that so that people maybe could understand a bit, this is why we are not cohering. This is why we're always arguing about this thing. You know, maybe we're just thinking about time differently.
Yeah, so Gracie, we in preparation for this conversation, we asked you to bring a few, or you said actually that you are thinking about art these days and sort of also engaging with art, practicing art yourself. And we're very curious to have a longer conversation about that towards the end. But we asked you to bring a few pieces of art that you really have recently or long-term been inspired by. And the first piece that we're going to have a conversation about or that we're going to have is, it's Dance Number 4 by Philip Glass for organs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to have a listen to it. And then maybe afterwards you can explain to us or describe to us what it does for you or how it resonates with you.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about this piece?
I can talk about it, but I I wanted you guys to say what your reactions are to it.
Oh, nice.
So I listened to this piece for the very first time yesterday morning. And it got me, it very much got me in a mood, sort of like it for me, it really sets the mood in a way, in both a good way and sort of like I find it, it's also like there's some nervousness to it maybe where I like, you know, I become sort of alert, but then also it makes me sort of awake. I feel awake, maybe not the right term, but sort of like wakes me up my mind starts working. So, this is just really just a visceral experience of listening to this piece for the very first time. I don't have any sort of like more abstract notions of what this makes me think of on larger terms. But yeah. That's how I listen to it.
Yeah. And I have a totally different experience, but
interesting.
I see kind of landscapes and have a train kind of feeling of being on the move, on the road, and a wide feeling. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm waving my hand.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, I mean, even just having listened to it then, I just feel delighted.
That's amazing.
I just feel delighted. I think like you, Reba, it wakes me up. I'm like, oh yeah, ready to go. And it makes my head quite busy. But I also find it very expansive. And I love the bass notes that kind of just come crashing in. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I don't do it very often because I have neighbors. But I just really love to turn it up really loud when I'm at home on my own and just listen to it, because there's a certain kind of thought that it stops, because it's just so loud and so busy and so kind of, I don't know, it's kind of psychedelic or transcendental or something. I couldn't be thinking about, God, what do I worry? I worry about all kinds of things, but you know, like, have I put the washing out? There's loads of stuff where it just kind of blasts it out of your mind. And it's kind of really epic. I don't know, it makes me think about all of the epic landscapes and sea journeys and stuff that I've been on. So,
and is there also a particular reason why you chose it for this conversation, for this episode?
Maybe because there are things that I love that it's like, how would this come up in a conversation about border abolition, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm like, I love Philip Glass and I love this song, and therefore I want to make room to talk about it.
Excellent, you know? Reason.
It's just a thing I would love to talk about. But I think also my relation to it is that there's something quite meditative about it, because I know where it's going. But also, again, my poor neighbors. Yeah, I grew up playing the piano and the violin and other things, but I play a lot of Philip Glass on the piano. So listening, it's not that I have any great or deep acquaintance with what it is to play the organ, right? But having just played some Philip Glass on the piano, I just am like, this is so fast. The time signatures change. It's in contrary motion. So there's something about appreciating the skill and knowing that, you know, there are some Philip Glass pieces where, you know, I can play most of the piece, but there's a bit where one hand will go into one time signature, another will go into another. And I'm just like, I can't play it. And I respect the people who can. And there's just something about, you know, but I still practice. There's just something about kind of recognizing that maybe you're not very good at something and appreciating someone else's skill in doing it.
Well, I don't know the way you talk about it now, it's I also don't necessarily envision a conversation about border abolition where this would naturally come up, but it really does tie in a way, sort of like this expansion, like more expansive notion of where you get your inspiration from, sort of, and also the search for building things, you know, like, as you said, not just about absence, but also about presence and
what it is you love
and sort of like tapping into that kind of loving energy of and life itself, you know. So I think it's actually very beautiful.
And it's exactly also the life that borders kind of and prisons crush. That's right. Trying to, or, and I must say, unsuccessfully.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shall we move to talk about a very important part of your book?
Mm.
And that is the idea of non-reformist reforms.
Mm-hmm.
The non-reformist reforms you describe as a kind of practical framework, questions you can ask yourself as you are organizing,
mm.
changes in the here and now that can reduce the power and permanence of borders. And then while, I guess, directing our energy also towards building those futures
mm-hmm.
that we want to build.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about the idea of non-reformist reforms, where it comes from,
yeah.
and how you translated it to the topic of borders?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, non-reformist reforms is a term coined by André Gortz, in fact, in thinking about anti-capitalism. Mm-hmm. An anti-capitalist organizing. It's a framework that's been used by prison abolitionists for a long time. And again, you know, if you listen to Angela Davis speak, you'll hear her say, you know, there's not a single prison abolitionist who doesn't want something to change right here, right now, in this
mm-hmm.
moment.
Mm-hmm.
The question is that change going to make prison abolition more or less possible?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, my friend Sita Balani talks about abolition and non-reformist reform specifically is maybe helping us bridge that binary between reform and revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So non-reformist reforms, as you articulated it completely right, it's, you know, it's a change that happens in the here and now that does not foreclose, but maybe even opens up the possibility of a more radical change in the future. And again, we draw on the work of critical resistance in particular. Mariam Makaba has also done this in setting out some questions that we can ask ourselves to help us think through, is something a reformist reform or a non-reformist reform? And it's not that Luke and I think that you can divide into neat categories. This one will definitely lead to abolition and this one will not, right? That's
yeah.
not
That's
the
again
point.
The absence of the roadmap.
Exactly. The absence of the roadmap. Yeah, we're not thinking deterministically about these things, and it will really depend on a specific time and a specific context and
mm-hmm.
what the opportunity actually is. You know, we discuss amnesties, for example. It's not impossible that there can be a political moment in which an amnesty is going to open the way to further change, the kind of change that we want to see. But what we point out is that a lot of the time, amnesties come with conditions that
yeah.
are, in fact, kind of future crackdowns. So
yes.
it's kind of, fine, we're going to regularize these people, but the ones that come after them, it's going to be worse for this reason, and this reason. Or, yes, we'll regularize these people, but actually here are a load of conditions. You know, you have to have been here for a certain amount of time. You have to be of such and such nationality. You have to have no criminal convictions, etc. I suppose what we try and point towards with the amnesties example is that there is a lot of history to suggest that amnesties have been implemented in completely reformist ways. That's not to say nobody can or should ever support an amnesty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is like, let's not call it something
yeah.
that it's not. And let's not say, oh, well, this is really likely to make it easier to organize towards prison abolition, when actually we know very often these are the conditions they come with. And really, maybe what's valuable in that discussion of amnesties is to put people on their guard so that, yeah, they might decide that they want to campaign for an amnesty for XYZ reason, but they might have thought about in their strategy, okay, it's really likely that they're going to try and add some terrible conditions to this.
Yeah.
How are we going to preempt that? Or how are we going to use this to make life easier for people who come even after the amnesty? Let's think about that in advance.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the point isn't to prescribe and to categorize. It's to help us do things differently and make the changes that we want to make. You know, the last thing that Luke and I want to do is kind of trap people in inaction because they're fearful of doing the wrong thing. Because ultimately,
yeah.
like, you're going to have to do something, and part of it's probably going to go wrong. And the question is, how are you going to respond to that? So yeah, it's not about having hard and fast rules, but it's, can we think some of this through in advance so that we aren't just calling for the same old thing that's been called for ages without without some critical analysis.
Yeah, yeah. I gotta say, I love this about listening to other interviews that you and Luke gave. So one actually that you listened to this morning, I
mm-hmm.
think, and one that I listened to a while back, I think it's where you're interviewed by Ben Smoke, who was part of the Stansted 15.
Yeah.
For listeners who don't know, activists who blocked a deportation flight and then were prosecuted super harshly by the UK government for terrorism charges, I think.
Yeah, terrorism charges.
You can look into their case. But you were interviewed by him, and at some point he comes up with, I think, a really vulnerable and beautiful example of how, in the wake of being prosecuted, how they got a lot of media attention and how they found themselves kind of picking out and uplifting and kind of putting forth a story of a woman who was particularly, whose story was particularly tragic. And he kind of put this to you, knowing that both of you bonded over that idea of working against innocence, not taking the most innocent person on the flight, but actually taking the most, maybe the person you have least sympathies for, and the importance of standing next to that person. So Ben Smoke kind of put towards you, like, I guess a bit, like, what do you think of that? The fact that we did that. And you gave this beautiful, really generous answer that that's when I really thought, ah, I'm looking forward so much to talking to you. Because one thing that I particularly remember from it is that you make a couple of distinctions. First of all, you kind of acknowledge the fact that indeed that is exactly the kind of politics that you write against. Okay. But then you say that you sympathize with the situation that they were in, and that in some rooms, talking to some people, making a point that's maybe not so radical can be radical. But more importantly, because the thing that kind of touched me and is that you say it's not only about that moment saying the right thing. It's about what comes after. For example, what do you do the next day? What do you do when you talk to that same person? Maybe now you have their phone number of that newsroom person. Maybe you can write a follow-up piece saying, well, I said this. And another point you made is you reminded him that there's much more to their action than just the things they said when being interviewed, and what they made possible by blocking the plane for you, people like you, the more radical infiltrators at that time in NGOs, what that action made possible for you, what that action makes possible for future generations of people thinking of direct action, all of that. And it, I just thought, what a kind, generous way to respond to that. And also props to him for like bringing that up.
Absolutely. It was, you know, it was a really, it was a very vulnerable reflection. And those, those were conversations that were happening at the time. And there were kind of smaller intervention, you know, like maybe a couple of us tweeted, you know, let's remember everybody on the plane, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, they put their freedom on the line to stop that plane. And I think that, there is something, maybe it links with the point I was making earlier about the best speakers then being looked to for all this. But it's, the one media line. Obviously, these things accumulate. And when you say them again and again and again, and when that's always your go-to argument, and when you allow the frame to become that narrow, you know, like that is a problem.
That is a problem.
That is a problem. So it's not to deny that, but also to lose sight of the whole action and what was at stake and what was made possible, I think is, is to fall into this trap of we're just going to comms our way out of, you know, centuries of systemic oppression. It's like, know, if the one thing, let's reflect on how that media stuff played out, but that cannot be like the one thing that people get stuck on.
Yeah. And we really need this in our movements, I feel, where we both critique and recognize the work people do and the risks people take.
And I mean, that's the thing. It just has to come from a human. We just have to relate to each other in a human. And I guess what there is in that interaction is the fact that we were all in the same room together, right? We weren't tweeting. We weren't texting. That was actually the first time that I'd met Ben, right? So it's not that we knew, he and Luke knew each other, but he and I didn't really know each other. But it was kind of, okay, in there are moments where you make commitments to relate to one another in particular ways, with a certain kind of kindness and open-heartedness. And, you know, the more that we can do that, the more that we can say, well, yeah, in that moment, that maybe wasn't the best thing to say. And if you went through your whole life always doing that, then I would get gradually less generous as you, as you raised it. But, you know, I think, yeah, we need relationships in which we can have those conversations. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, so maybe earlier I said that one of the things that the book really gives us is a different kind of language to think about struggle. But it also really gives us this, right? Like sort of concrete ways of thinking about direct action. And maybe that's even more important. No, let's not go into what is more important or not. That's also really important. And I was wondering maybe, because we talked a little bit about how amnesty might not be the right, or might not always open up the way to towards a world without borders. But maybe you can give a few examples of sort of a, or one is already quite useful, I guess. But of a sort of an example of a non-reformist reform that
would shrink the system.
That would shrink it.
Yeah, sort of a direct action that shrinks the system.
That shrinks it. I mean, I think that you know, I've done a lot of work on firewalling, i.e. making sure that data that's held for one purpose can't be used for another purpose without somebody's knowledge and or consent. And I think that there's something, you know, firewalls are a great non-reformist reform in that, you know, you're basically campaigning to say, look, if somebody presents to health services because, you know, they're ill, you can't then use their address to send immigration enforcement officers after them. Similarly, if somebody sends their child to school, you shouldn't be able to use that information for immigration enforcement. Basically, it helps to de-link access to essential public services from a person's immigration status, and it helps reduce the reach of the immigration system into a person's life. But of course, what it also does outside of the immigration sphere is, for all of us, it kind of creates a presumption that actually, no, we're not just going to have, the state is not going to just have one massive data set, and it's not going to pass stuff around without our consent and knowledge for, you know, whatever purposes. Because one minute it's immigration control and another minute it's disability benefit fraud or, you know, protest or whatever. So firewalls, I think, are a great non-reformist reform. Campaigns for universal access to public services, non-conditional access to public services. And that's an interesting one, because depending on the state of play in a particular place, there's loads of conditions that you might want to be getting rid of that aren't just to do with, they might be to do with income status, or they might be to do with, you know, proof of disability, or, you know, so there are ways to bring people together, and there are lots of different arguments that you can make for kind of non-conditionality, especially when most of the time these systems cost way more to administer than they do save money. You know, that's obviously only one argument among many, but there's, you know, there's lots of different entry points for people.
And there's lots of research that shows that the moment you start limiting social services to a certain group, the political attention is directed towards frauds, right? People who are frauding the system.
Yeah, so again, you're constantly looking for someone who's not innocent, and you're profiling and producing people who are not innocent in that way, or who are not entitled, who then go on to behave in all the ways that the state said that they were going to anyway. And it's like, well, no, maybe if you just let them have access to that service or whatever it was they needed, they wouldn't have had to do X, Y, Z. So,
Yeah, and there's been in different European countries, like you have the Koppelingswet in the Netherlands and Italy, Germany. You see everywhere in the last two decades, three decades, you see that these link-ups between access to the welfare state and legal status have been kind of legislated into law. But that also shows us how recent it is and how we can, how a world without those linkages is really imaginable. Even though maybe now in the technological hellscape that we're in, it becomes a bit less imaginable. But we have to remember that when I was a little kid, this wasn't the case.
Exactly. And I think that that's another part of the abolitionist temporality, right? Pointing out, well, actually, you know, for centuries, people did things, and especially, you know, in countries, well, places before they were colonized, etc., there were many ways of doing things that did not involve XYZ. I mean, even just in the UK, the foundation of UK immigration law was legislated for in 1971. You know, 1971. It came in after my mum was born. You know? I think part of the like constant reign of hostility that traps us in defending the status quo, part of what that serves to do is to shorten time to basically just right now. It stops us even thinking about, okay, but even hostile environment, 2012, 2014, 2016, you know, it's like, okay, so in my lifetime, there was not this system of checks for public services, etc.
I really love this idea of refusing the binary between revolution and reform and thinking of concrete things to do in the here and now to shrink the system. But then actually a lot of work, and it is important work, is firefighting, right? It's just holding back. Shrinking the system is one way to envision it. But another way to envision it is leaving people after you in a better place. And I think that broadens the scope to include also firefighting. But then, of course, once you start including firefighting, there's also this tricky morass that you enter where firefighting super easily turns into kind of just reformist reforms.
And I think, I suppose for us, one of the, and for me in particular, again, because of the work that I've been doing in professionalized spaces, we just really wanted to emphasize that actually firefighting is not enough. It's insufficient. It's necessary, but insufficient. And I suppose some of that thinking around ecosystem is around the fact that not everybody can firefight. Or if everybody firefights, there are all of these other things that you need that don't happen, can't happen, disappear. And so you just stay in the same place or kind of just getting incrementally worse.
Yeah, a strong ecosystem is a system where lots of people do lots of different things.
Exactly.
And not everyone is, then it's a ecosystem taken over by one species.
Exactly. And you know, you just, in the UK in particular, you really do just get people bouncing from, well, there's been, you know, it's a classic tool of right-wing governments. In the UK has included both political parties in recent history. But, you know, just like every 2 years, new immigration bill. More frequently than that, new immigration bill. And it's kind of...
It's just smacking people in the face with new agendas.
And it's just, things okay, to deal
with. Occupying them as well.
Are we going to learn the lesson that... And, you know, it would be one thing if every time we fought the bill didn't pass. But that's not what happens. Somebody manages to take some of the edges off and some of the anger and outrage and action that people take around the bill then means that people go into other kinds of organizing around an issue. But if you recognize that that's what actually happens, to me, that says, okay, let two big, uninteresting NGOs brief on the bill and do some amendments. And all the other 30 groups who are maybe going to get involved, could you do something else?
All right.
You know?
And what I really like about the two examples that you give about these firewalls and universal access to welfare is that it also opens up to thinking about what that ecosystem involves, because it's not just people who come from a no border activism or migrant justice struggles, etc., but it really allows us to also envision a much wider ecosystem, right? Where it's also people, as you said, like other kinds of people who might be targeted in the future, but actually really all of us, because all of us could become a target at some point of these forms of exclusion and categorizing, etc.
Even though some people are more likely to become targets than others,
of course. But I was wondering, because this links a little bit to something that we also wanted to talk to you about today, sort of this the work that goes into building and sustaining an ecosystem, as you put it, and sort of or coalition building in maybe more regular kind of language.
Solidarity
movements. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how sort of abolitionist thinking, abolition of borders, how that thinking helps us also in thinking about that part of the struggle, you know?
Well, I really enjoy listening to Ruthie Gilmore talk about, now what was it called? California Prison Moratorium Project, I think is what it was called. But I really enjoy listening to Ruthie talk about kind of their abolitionist campaigning, because she is, and so that's one example, but I also, a couple of years ago, really enjoyed listening to an organizer talking about abortion reform in Ireland and the referendum and the kind of discipline that it took to get that over the line. Because what's really clear in both of those, both of the ways that those organisers speak about those things, is that these were not strategies that relied only on a very small radical group of people running a kind of outlier campaign and somehow getting what they wanted. That what was involved was bringing people in who had an interest in some way and not the classic meeting them where they're at and then staying there. But, you know, saying to people who cared about the environment, for example, this is why this prison is going to be bad for the environment. This is this campaign. You know, these are some of the arguments that you might want to run. And it wasn't about necessarily turning them into abolitionists, but it was about building a coalition that supported this one change in that moment, which was stop this prison getting built, which was the abolitionist goal, right?
Yeah, and I think Ruth Wilson Gilmore also says, is kind of pragmatic in this, like, make sure that the infrastructure closes down and do what you need to do to get that done.
Yeah, and that's what I remember this campaigner who, it's a shame that I can't remember her name, but she was from a pretty radical group. And she talked about, you know, the difficulties of being from this radical, grassroots, unfunded group that didn't have paid staff, that was having to meet with organisations that had completely different political analysis, had paid staff, you know, all the meetings were at the wrong time. But I remember the phrase that she used was revolutionary discipline in terms of the arguments that they had to make. They were going out, knocking doors, the conversations that they were having to have to get people to vote the way they needed to vote for them to get access to abortion. You know, she was like, that was not the moment for certain. And she was speaking about a very specific window in the weeks running up to the vote. So she absolutely wasn't saying there's no room in this conversation for more radical arguments. But she was kind of saying in that moment to get that specific outcome, we understood what we needed to do. And that's what we did. So, yeah, I think there is, there's something about pragmatism. But again, there's something about pragmatism that's not, that doesn't close the way to whatever you might want to do going forward. So it's not
because that's a waste of energy.
Exactly. So it's not that you go out and you make, so I can't actually think of a bad argument for abortion right now, but it's not so it's not that you go out and you only make arguments about fetal abnormalities, right? She's not, she's not saying that you that you keep it that closed, but the point is, in that moment, in that time, you know what your goal is, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, well, maybe also because, I don't know, thinking about an ecosystem and all of this, is it sounds very beautiful in many ways. But in other occasions, we have also heard you speak about sort of the reliance on certain kinds of people to do a whole lot of the work. And these ecosystems very often not being free of lots of kinds of hierarchies that we find elsewhere also, and that we are actually fighting, but then seep into the ways in which we relate to each other and organize together. So I was maybe wondering if you would want to talk to us about that as well a little bit.
Yeah, I can definitely speak to that. And I suppose that's part of what I alluded to at the beginning in terms of why abolition makes sense to me. Because, you know, I've been in grassroots, radical, more anarchist spaces where, you know, some kind of harm would happen and nobody wanted to touch any of it with a 10-foot barge pole, and it would be left to women, and in particular racialized women, to, you know, support whoever had been harmed and also try and kind of poke everybody else. I remember just having a real battle to just be like, can you just, you know, somebody's written a whole handbook on transformative justice. Can you just read it? You know, can the one commitment you make be, do you read all the time, you cite all kinds of stuff. Could you just read it? No. So that was, you know, that was abolish the police white dudes, right? So that's something I don't have much, I don't have much time for. And then in professional spaces, I mean, again, there's a limit to how much airtime I ever really want to give it. But suffice to say that, many of those professional NGO spaces have just been extremely white, extremely liberal, predominantly women, which means that white supremacy manifests itself in a particular way. That means that, yes, all of a sudden speech becomes really dangerous. Speech and tone and robustness all become terrifying, and conflict absolutely is abuse in those contexts. And I suppose one of the things that's really driven me up the wall and still does is people dissolving. White women dissolving in the face of, you know, somebody saying, well, you've done this thing and it's had this impact and this kind of disavowal of power. You know, I've had these conversations in relation to pay, for example, and reforms of pay structures where people have wielded massive institutional power over people's material circumstances. And then when people have kind of said that, I'm not super happy about how that's gone, dissolving. And I'm kind of like, where is this person? They're a puddle on the floor. It's why? Like,
I kind of related to this deep investment of seeing yourself as a good person. And that's maybe especially a white woman thing. I say as a white woman. And when that's challenged, just dissolving.
And not being
able to face that.
Not facing, and also just not coming from a place that recognizes, like, we all do harm to each other. You know, I'm not moving through the world like I am perfect and everyone's interaction with me will be amazing. Like, no. I hope that I can hear it if you say it and maybe do something differently, and also figure out what you'd like from me to feel better, or some kind of restitution like that I am committed to. But that's because my starting point is that, I'm definitely going to mess up.
In a recent interview that Fred Moten did on the podcast Millennials Are Killing Capitalism, he talks about kind of empty posturing solidarity. And then what's beneath that, he doesn't say this, so this is my interpretation, right? But beneath that is, of course, this implosion, if you actually then address that solidarity, right? But he calls that the bad breath of the white world. And I was kind of like, oh, that's... That one is deep.
I'm smelling it,
because it's like this, and he says it in the context of having to deal with this posturing solidarity as having to breathe in the bad breath of the white world that wants to kind of perform this goodness while not changing the material conditions that produce the things that are being challenged. But one thing we wanted to do, so you are also the host of a podcast series, which everyone should definitely listen to. It's called Locating Legacies. And in it, you kind of talk to six beautiful, great scholars about the work of Stuart Hall and their work and the relations between them. Only two episodes are online as we are recording this right now. So that's the only ones we can refer to. But in the first one, you talk to your friend Kojo Koram, and you ended the interview with a question that we wanted to actually pose back to you. And it's right on this topic. So as a final question, you talk about a dynamic where public and media discourse cannibalize Black public intellectuals, and how they can inure you, in your words, to critique and outrage and to kind of perform this condemnation, when actually your ideas and work are far more capacious and constructive than that. And you are far more interested in love than in outrage. And you asked Kojo to share some of the better ideas, the imaginative ideas, that he thinks we should be leaning on to build our way out of our current predicament. So, and we wanted to ask you that. What are some of those better ideas?
What are some of these better ideas? God, it was a big question I asked him, wasn't it?
now you
lucky,
feel it.
Lucky Kojo. I know. Now I'm feeling the podcast from the other side and feeling a little bit of sympathy for these people. Part of it for me goes back to, you know, we talked before about kind of where my spark is, or what I find, what I find generative and nourishing. I suppose it's in the framing of that question, in that I wish we would give more space in our organizing, in our political conversations, in our political practice, to the things that we love. You know, very often you're talking about these really, or organizing around these really enormous, scary, and, you know, for many of us, our lives have been personally touched in some way by these things. And we give all of this space to this, and then we... yeah, I don't know. We don't make space for, okay, but if we weren't doing this work, what would we be doing? Like, mm-hmm. just giving moments to how would you occupy yourself? What would you be eating? Who would you be with? Mm-hmm. What would the quality of your day-to-day life be like? I think, for me, yeah, part of it is a reorientation for me. And I suppose it comes back to this point around what Black public intellectuals are for. But for me, I'm like, I'm not actually on this earth to be really angry about, like, I don't love it. I don't love being angry about everything. I don't love that this stuff happens to anyone. And Ruthie Gilmore talks about herself as part of the prison industrial complex, right? And I'm like, yeah, I don't, there are so many things that I would be doing with my life day in, day out, if I wasn't doing this. This is not my raison d'être. This is like the bare minimum that I think I have to be doing in order to get a bit closer to doing more of the stuff that I love. So I think there's something about recognizing that also we can't live our lives like waiting for that moment when we get to utopia. Like, we actually have to practice it in the here and now. So we have to give it room in our political spaces and in our political conversations, because I think that's what it is to let each other be human together. Mm-hmm. And so for me, a big part of that is the arts. It is literature. Like, those are the things that I absolutely love. And I think that when we think about, you know, in our ecosystem, there aren't enough people, right? So our ecosystems actually are very, very small and overstretched. And people are really burnt out and tired and knackered and just, you know, it's really hard. And I think that obviously a huge part of that is that the world is as it is, and like, we are dealing with things that are terrible, but it's also because we think that's not okay to have room for these things. And so I just, when I think about what illuminates me and what draws me to things and makes me want to do stuff, part of it is like, oh, there's room for some creativity here. Or maybe we're going to do this together. Maybe we're going to imagine this together. Doesn't have to be all of it, and it can't be a disproportionate part of it. But I would love it if we would, yeah, make room for the things that we find beautiful in our political lives.
Yeah, and you have been doing some of that, right? So as I said earlier, we asked you to bring a few of the pieces of art or art engagements that you've been working on, and you also thought to bring a poem that you wrote yourself. Perhaps this is a good moment for you to read that to us.
I can read it to you.
I just want to say that I actually haven't read the poem yet, so no, this is going to be the first time that we hear it. Maybe that will make for a, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, well, it will make for something.
Well, I'm going to give it a caveat, which is that also in all of my waxing lyrical about art, et cetera, is, and I guess I touched on it earlier, I also am letting myself be like not great at stuff. I'm letting myself be a bit bad at things and just enjoy the fact that I've done them. So it's not that I don't think this is, I'm not convinced this is a great poem, right? And actually whenever I write poems, I leave them alone for a little while and then I go back to them and I'm like, not sure about that, which is what I did with this one.
And then you need another 5 years and then you appreciate them again.
And then maybe you change it around in between and like whatever. And I guess this is, you know, what it is to make art. But the kind of backstory with this one is that I quit my job. I quit my stressful job that was making me ill and I was taking a year out. And then all of a sudden I had this energy in the middle of the night to sit on my phone and write poems. And and it was my partner's 30th was coming up and I was like, what am I going to give him? And so I made a little book of like 5 poems and a set of photographs from, you know, just stuff that we've done together. But for me, this was an intellectual exercise in form because I've just never written a sonnet. But that's testament to the little space you get in your brain when other things don't happen. So anyway, this one's called On Ending. And as I say, it's my first attempt at a sonnet. And if we were to keep our faces turned to high winds, salt spray, mountain humming green, and if, ending, the two of us had been a major lift spilled lucent through this world, and if it came to nothing, all we'd learned, and sequined glow and giant's eye half seen was all this quiet companionship might mean, our human urge to linger fast adjourned, I'd be content with rapture by the wind. I'd leech into rich silt, the levees spent. I'd sink and cut my own path through the clay. And if, as four hands, warm half ice half limbed, my dusk breath fears the final summons sent, I'd go. You know I'd love you more each day.
Beautiful. I'm gonna let that sit. But it does speak to the final thing we wanted to talk about today, and that is love. Something that, interestingly, Black revolutionary women have written a lot about. Love, hope, and kind of radical care. I'm just going to throw out some people that seem to have inspired you. So Maria Makaba, who you've mentioned a few times, writes about hope as a discipline. Les Beck, who I think is someone that Luke finds very inspiring, and maybe you as well, where he says, a worldly attentiveness to what is emerging in the conditions of the present. And you quote Ernst Bloch, who writes that the work of hope requires people who throw themselves actively into what is becoming, to which they themselves belong, but this throwing actively. And that's also something that Rebecca Solnit writes about, kind of give yourself to the future. And we were wondering if you could talk a little bit about this revolutionary hope. For me, it's when you kind of combine the, again, looking this beast in the eye, not being naive about the devastation, the horror, the repression, but maybe even through that, through looking that into the eye and giving yourself still to struggling against it. What that maybe means or something like that.
And I guess, and actually I haven't said this, you know, Luke and I, we weren't intending for our book to be prescriptive, and it also isn't just ours, you know, it didn't just come out of our heads and then we enlightened the people and they went forth and did border abolition, right? That's not the point. And so, our book is very much, the product of all kinds of collective struggles, obvious, a collective endeavor between the two of us. But as you've said, we weren't trying to set out a roadmap. And I think for me, that's where the hope is in the fact that it's not determined. Yeah, maybe some things are more likely than other things on the ground of the world as it is. But actually, like, we don't know. And there are points of intervention. And it's not as if, you know, it's not how theories of change work really anymore. It's not as if we say, well, if we do X, then Y is going to happen. But the point is that there are these openings and we can jump into them, and we don't know what's definitely going to happen, but we can look back at what other people who've been jumping have done before and how that's gone for them. And we can say, okay, well, on the basis of what we can see, we're going to give it a go. And there's a possibility. That's the point. There's a possibility that we could make things how we want them to be.
I'm still thinking about the poem, I'm sorry. No, I thought it was very beautiful, the poem, and it spoke to me about sort of, you know, like in sort of self-help literature, there's this idea of finding peace with oneself, and it's very individualized. But for me, the poem was really about sort of finding peace in relationship to one another as well. And I thought it captured that for me very beautifully. So thank you for bringing it, actually. Yeah, very beautiful.
Yeah, maybe we're going to end on another piece of art, a final one. You chose to read a meditation. It's written by Alexis Pauline Gums. And
So Undrowned, Black Feminist Lessons from Marine Mammals is a book that I picked up after I saw Alexis Pauline Gums speak at a conference that was called Sensing the Planet, that took place at the same time as COP26. It was a kind of counterpoint to what was happening in COP26, which was obviously up in Glasgow, and we were all down in Devon, and Paul Gilroy was one of the big animating forces of that conference. And Ruthie Gilmore was there virtually, and it was a really special, interesting conference. And Alexis Pauline Gums was asking people to formulate questions and to think of a number, and then she would read a passage from the book that corresponded, the page number would correspond with the number that a person had thought of. And there were just a lot of beautiful correspondences between the questions that were asked and the page numbers and what was actually on the page. Mm. And I found her speaking really mesmerizing. But also, again, weirdly, it was one of these texts that sort of unified various things for me that had been disparate interests, you know, because I, at school, always said I wanted to be a marine biologist. Mm. And every so often now, I still think maybe I will do my STCW and just learn to work on a boat. You know, to know that
your this escape.
Book... yeah, your my escape. My escape. So, yeah, to know that this book existed, yeah, it was gorgeous. So this is a meditation from really close to the start, number one, and it's called Listen. How can we listen across species, across extinction, across harm? How does echolocation, the practice many marine mammals use to navigate the world through bouncing sounds, change our understandings of vision and visionary action? Is social media already a technology of bounce, of throwing something out there and seeing what comes back? This is where we start our trans-species communion, opening a space to uplift the practice of listening even more than the practices of showing and proving and speaking up. Listening is not only about the normative ability to hear, it is a transformative and revolutionary resource that requires quieting down and tuning in.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you for being here with us today, Gracie Mae Bradley.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And for bringing these beautiful pieces of art for us and like sharing what inspires you. Yeah, it's very inspiring for us interns. Thank you.
I've loved it.
Such a pleasure. Before closing this episode, we would like to thank a few people and collectives. B Carrot for the illustrations we use on our social media accounts, Thomas from Dark Roast for the graphic design, Joris and David and Ellen and Neske for the theme music, and Medusa Magic Studio for allowing us to use their space to record this episode. And a special shout out to Luke, who couldn't come over to Amsterdam, but who we felt was there in spirit throughout.